Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I'd like to wish everyone a good afternoon, and I'm very glad to be back here again. The theme for the afternoon's talk is this sound a bit adjustable? There is something wrong with my sound. So, hello, 1, 2, 3. Okay, that sounds better. Yes. So the afternoon's theme is there is something wrong with me. Also implying there might be something wrong with you as well. But, so last week, those of you who were here, the theme was that of forgiveness, and during the course of that, we touched a bit upon looking at our own sense of self-criticism or negativity directed towards ourselves. And so this is picking up on that particular part of the theme and exploring some of that quality of feeling of imperfection in ourselves. Last week, the theme was more, in this respect, was more about how the thinking mind can take hold of a negative impression or a criticism and then take it and run with it and make it into a problem of guilt or a severe negativity. But the voice of the inner tyrant always criticizing us and complaining and blaming and looking at everything that we do or think or say as being stupid or wrong or bad or embarrassing or just generally off. I thought that for the theme of today, this is more to do with looking at the very essential feeling of I-ness and me-ness, of my-ness, the very sense of self, and how that is addressed in the Buddhist teachings, because this is a central theme of Buddha Dhamma, Buddhist practice, and one of the things that also makes it somewhat unique in terms of the approach to spiritual training, spiritual practice. Now, when we think of ourselves, sometimes it can be hard to pin down, who we are. And years ago, before I became a monk, I used to wonder a lot, which is the real me. Which is the person that I can truly identify with, or what's the characteristics that I really feel at home with? Because when I was a teenager, I found that I moved in about 5 different worlds, and so there was the realm of the family and my sisters, my parents, my cousins, and there was the family world and my role and personality in that. The youngest of 3 children, and mom and dad and grandparents and so forth. And that's sort of me as part of the family and one of the Horners. That's who I am. And then when I was at school, in secondary school, then there was the friends that I had and hanging out with this sort of gang of drunken public school rowdies. That was a very different identity than the sort of dutiful son that I was with the family. They're here with these sort of raucous youths running around Kent and London. Then when I was at university, then with I was doing a degree at London University, and there you are attending lectures and going to tutorials with the psychology department, physiology department, and trying to be this sort of studious and intelligent, creative academic, you know, impressing people with your insights and your knowledge and so forth. So there was this sort of intellectual person. And also growing up, I spent a lot of time riding horses and around the horse and dog world, and so that a lot of the friends of the family down in Kent where I grew up, this was very much the hunt and shoot and fishing crowd, you know, Green Wellingtons and gin and tonic gang, and so when I and but the interesting thing was that. When I was with the horse and hound gin and tonic crowd, then I felt very much at home with them, and I could play along with that world. And then when I was in the university, I could play along with that world. When I was with the family, I could do that. When I was out drinking with my old school friends, I would do that. And then living in London during those student years, I often found myself hanging out in these kind of anarchist hippie squats. This was in the mid-70s when there was a lot of that sort of thing was about. And so there I was with all these kind of countercultural hippie anarchists and felt totally at home with that. So I began to think, well, hang on. which one's the real me? Where do I fit into this? Because I can match my conduct and my attitudes with each of these worlds to some degree or another. But which one's the real one? And the more I looked, if any of you remember the Winnie the Pooh, there's a time when Winnie the Pooh has lost Piglet and he's trying to follow him around in the snow. And there's this beautiful expression where it says, the more Pooh looked, the more that Piglet wasn't there. He's following his footsteps in the snow, if I remember. So it was that kind of experience. Is the more that I looked for the real me, the more I couldn't pin it down on anything. The more, in a way, I wasn't there. So this was at the time, because I didn't have any understanding or knowledge of Buddhism at all, let alone any kind of experience of meditation. This was very distressing, because in a way, the harder I looked, the less there was anything real there. So at that time, that was very unsettling and disorienting. Led to some kind of major psychological crises during that time, because I thought, well, I don't really exist. There really isn't anything here. This is a disaster. There's no real me. This is an identity crisis. And I thought I was going crazy. So a few years later, after I'd encountered Buddhism and started hearing about the teachings on anatta and selflessness, and learning a little bit about Buddhist meditation and Buddhist perspective on things, then I realized, oh no, that's great. Rather than this being a psychological problem, this is actually a beneficial result of meditation, is that same insight into this lack of solidity or the lack of definable identity. And that the teachings point directly to that. And that one of the things that's wrong with me is that we take ourselves too seriously. We take the me, the I, the mine, to be an absolute reality. And just as my experience as a confused teenager, you start to open it up, and then the more you look, the more there isn't really anybody there. There isn't any solid person there. And rather than thinking of this as a weakness, the Buddha says, look, isn't this how it is? And that one of the problems, what is wrong with me? And when we put this title together for the talk, notice there was an inverted commas around the me. There is something wrong with me. Meaning that the way that we handle that feeling of I-ness and me-ness and minus, that's the issue. That's the key point. The central teaching that the Buddha gave on this, which was very, very early on in his teaching career, what's often known as the second discourse, is called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the characteristic of not-self. And traditionally this was given to the group of the Buddha's five friends, five companions, in the deer park in Varanasi, not that long after the Enlightenment. After the Enlightenment of Bodhgaya, he'd walked to Varanasi and then joined up together with his five former companions. And then initially he'd given them the teaching on the middle way and the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakka, Pavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma was the first teaching. And during that teaching, only one of the five actually understood what he was saying. Only Kundanya became a stream enterer, entered the initial stages of the path. None of the other four had any significant or life-changing insight at that time. But it was during the second discourse, what's known as the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the discourse on not-self, that actually all five of them became fully enlightened. So in a way, the teaching on the Four Noble Truths in the middle way was sort of preparing the ground, and then the awakening of the liberating insight came with this teaching on not-self. And so this is one of the suttas that we recite in our monasteries, one of these first three sermons that we often recite in Pali, and also over the years that Lumbosamhita Sumedho would encourage a lot of reflection on, because there's some very key teachings in there, and also the morning chanting that we do contains a lot of the same teachings that are embodied in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And the basic framework of that teaching is around investigating the nature of body and mind. And in this instance, the Buddha divides it into the five convenient chunks, the five khandhas, or the five aggregates, or the five groups. And these are, the first one is rupa, which means the body or material form. And then the other four, that's the physical group, or the physical khandha. And the other four are the mental ones. That's feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. So this is a rough way of chunking body and mind, nama and rupa, together. And what he does is the Buddha goes through this analytical process with his friends. And he starts off by saying, is form, is material form, is the body permanent or impermanent? And they say, well, it's impermanent, the body changes all the time. So is that which is impermanent and changing? Can that be perfectly satisfactory? Is that dukkha or sukha? Is that satisfactory or unsatisfactory? Well, anything that changes can't possibly be pleasing to us all of the time. So therefore, it would be dukkha or unsatisfactory. It's not something that can be permanently and absolutely pleasing. So you say it's dukkha. And then he took the analysis to its completion. Okay, that which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, can it be said of that? Can it truly be said of that? This is mine. This is what I am. This is myself. Etang mama eso hamasmi eso me ata. Can it be said truly that that's the who and what we are? And then the answer that they give is no, it can't. Because the implication is that if something is atta, something is our true self, it will be satisfactory, permanent, it will be pleasing. It will be an abiding and satisfying, invulnerable quality. So then he goes through each of the other aspects of the five khandhas, the body and mind, through feeling, perception, mental formations, that means emotions, thoughts, ideas, motivations and so forth, memories, all those aspects of the mental world. And consciousness itself, the very faculty of cognizing, of knowing. And he says, can it be said of this, is it changing, is it not changing? Is it satisfactory, is it unsatisfactory? Okay, that which is changing, that which is unsatisfactory, can you say of this, this is mine, this is what I am, this is myself? To which they reply, no. No he tang bante. So that he leads them through their own investigation, their own experience, to this conclusion of recognizing that no, you can't say any aspect of the body and mind is a true individual permanent self. So rather than trying to define what a true self is, capital S, or our kind of real identity, he instead points to letting go of what we're not, because then he says, so therefore, the wise, noble disciple recognizes that the realm of material form, inside, outside, coarse or fine, pure or impure, far or near, whatever kind of material form, whatever kind of body, whether it's a material object, a possession, or another person, or a mountain, or our own body, it cannot be said of that, this is me, this is mine, this is what I, this is myself, this belongs to me. It can't be said of that. So similarly, a feeling, a perception, mental formations, and even consciousness, it can't be said of that. Therefore, the wise, noble disciple lets go and does not create an identification with those five groups, those aspects of body and mind. So rather than trying to define a true self or even define an ultimate reality, he says, let go of what you're, of the habit of identifying with what you're not, and then what's real will become apparent. And that at the end of that discourse, then all, as I said, all five of them became fully enlightened. So this is a very powerful teaching and something that bears a lot of investigation. It's also interesting that those three aspects, the qualities of mindness, etang mama, and the quality of is related to desire, to craving. Then, so the feeling of ownership is related to craving. The feeling of I am is a kind of conceit. And then the feeling of myself is a, in a way, a coarser kind of view of identification with the body and the personality. So these are called the gaha or the papancha dhammas. So these are tanha, mana, and ditti, craving, conceit, and views. So the craving is based around this quality of feeling of mindness. And the Pali word for mine is mama. So the primordial owning is of the baby, is mama. Like, that is mine, that's my mother. I don't think it's an entirely a coincidence that there is that basic relationship that we form, and that the word there in Pali of for mindness is mama, that is mine. Any of us who have ever been around babies and know how they relate to the mother, there's a very distinct sense of mine. My, you know, that's my safety, my security, my lunch. So these then are called the gaha, which means that the obsessions or the papancha dhammas, the causes of mental proliferation. And the way that the mind takes hold of those particular perceptions, it's really that is important to look at in this respect of how we make this error of taking those feelings of I and me and mine to be an absolute reality. And so particularly the process of insight meditation is aimed at exploring how do we create that feeling of I and me and mine, and how does that become solidified? How do we create that problem, that thing that is wrong with the me-ness? Because on their own, there's no problem. It's just a feeling that arises and passes away. But it's because of the clinging, the grasping hold of them, the way the mind obsesses on them, becomes a gaha. That's the issue. That's where it becomes problematic. Now, the word that the Buddha used to describe that kind of grasping is manyati, and it means to conceive. And in English, to conceive just means to form a thought or to bring something into being. But in Buddhist psychology, it particularly relates to the creation of the I am feeling and making that into holding that as if it was an ultimate reality. It's like making the I am into an ultimate truth. So just as in Western psychology we have the ego just is just a Latin word for I, but we make the that I feeling into me, right? And a lot of psychology is based around having a good solid ego. You know, even Buddhist psychologists will tell you, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. But they love to build upon the idea, you've got to have a good, solid, wholesome, healthy ego before you try and let go of it. And there is some basis to that. But oftentimes it's because of trying to create and hold on to a firm, separate, independent sense of I that we are creating the causes of alienation and discontent and incompletion, although we don't realize it. We're trying to make a firm and solid feeling of self. We're trying to make ourselves feel secure, but in that very effort to establish a firm and solid ego, we're actually strengthening the causes of alienation and dukkha, of suffering. Now, the Buddha outlined several different kinds of conceit. And in English, we tend to think of the word conceit as meaning being inflated, like someone is conceited. It means like I'm better than everybody else, right? That's what we think of being conceited, as someone who's proud or thinks a lot of themselves. But in Buddhist psychology, being conceited, it has many different dimensions. So this is a passage from the Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha says, "One who conceives I am equal, better or worse might on that account engage in disputes. But one not shaken in these three discriminations does not think I am equal or better. The equality conceit, the inferiority conceit and the superiority conceit," that's like thinking you're the same as, thinking you're worse than or thinking you're better, "this threefold conceit should be overcome. That one who has overcome this threefold conceit through the full penetration of conceit is said to have put an end to suffering. Those samanas and brahmins who, relying on the impermanent, unsatisfying and transitory nature of material form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness, conceive that I am better, or I am equal, or I am worse, all these imagined thus through not understanding reality." So it's a more expansive version of conceit. And if you want to get really thorough, there's what's called the nine types of conceit that that go, if you're superior and you think I'm superior, if you're superior and you think I'm the same as, if you're superior and you think I'm worse than, if you're equal and you think I'm better than, if you're equal and you think I'm equal, if you're equal and you think I'm worse than, or if you're inferior and you think I'm superior, or if you're inferior and you think I'm equal to, and if you're inferior and you think I'm inferior, all of those are conceit. So nine types. So anything that's got I am on it, it's wrong. So this is a really, in a way, a helpful way of outlining, because you might think, well, I'm just being realistic, you know. I am better than others. You know. Like even Ajahn Chah said that. He, I used to get so critical of all the other monks in the monastery. I think, you know, I can chant better than them. I can sit better than them. I can give better Dhamma talks. I keep the Vinaya more strictly than everybody else. I am better than them. It was true. But he could see that holding on to that and making that a cause to criticize and blame and alienate himself from others was only causing more suffering. So it's not about having a realistic assessment of how things are, let alone being deluded, like thinking that you're better than when you're really equal to or worse than. But it's every kind of conceiving, all the different kinds of manyati. So in this passage from the sutta number 140 in the Majjhima, the Buddha says, "Bhikkhu, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. Conceiving is a disease. Conceiving is a tumor. Conceiving is a barb. By overcoming all conceivings, Bhikkhu, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. They are not shaken and they are not agitated, for there is nothing present in them by which they might be born. Not being born, how could they age? Not aging, how could they die? Not dying, how could they be shaken? not being shaken, why should they be agitated? So a lot of these teachings on the development of insight meditation are about identifying those qualities, those habits of conceiving, and to recognize that and to learn how to not conceive ourselves. And this is very difficult to do because the world and our conditioning continually stokes that feeling of I am. We have a name, we have a life story, we've got a CV, we've got a family that keeps addressing us, and we have a social security number, we have bank account numbers, email addresses, all of these I ams that keep reaffirming who we are in different ways. What is most useful is to recognize the limited nature of that, and how we can just hang on to those identities and in a way try to make a refuge of them, even when they're things that are painful to us, even if they're things that are an uncomfortable identity, still we'll hang on to them. The great spiritual teacher Gurdjieff was one of the things that he said that I remember being introduced to a few years ago was people. He said that people will hang on to their suffering until death. You can take away anything from people except for their suffering, they'll hang on to that until death. That we want to at least grip onto that. And I was also reminded of a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. I think Calvin and Hobbes made it over to England, right? Yes. And where Calvin is this inspired little boy. It's also, I think, Calvin and Hobbes is a cartoon written by a philosophy graduate. It's like, what do you do when you get a university degree in philosophy? So you write cartoon strips. How to make money out of philosophy. And so Calvin says, nothing I do is my fault. My family is dysfunctional and my parents won't empower me. Yeah. Therefore, I'm not self-actualized. I'm the disease product of toxic codependency. I need wellness, I need health and wellness and personal security before I'll take responsibility for any of my actions. To which his partner, the tiger Hobbes, says, I think one of us needs to stick his head into a bucket of iced water. And Calvin's last word is, I love the culture of victimhood. So, in a way, sometimes in the cartoons we can find little home truths that reveal a lot about ourselves. So whether we have a negative self-view, or we have a problem, an unrequitable romance, an unforgivable feeling of resentment, or a feeling of wrong that we've done ourselves, like I was talking about last week in terms of forgiveness, we can still hang on to that, because at least that's a devil that we know. That's the I am that we know. And far better to have a big problem that I can't get rid of than to be faced with undefined being. Right? It's far more challenging to at least be a criminal. To be a failure than to not be able to define who and what we are. Because that quality of undefinedness is deeply threatening to the ego, but it's also very liberating to the heart. Now, one of the issues that is central to this is the feeling of wanting to be free. We desire freedom very powerfully, don't we? We have this feeling of, I'm hemmed in by life, I'm hemmed in by my body, my personality, my hang-ups, I'm hemmed in by my lack of income, by my difficult living situation. If only I didn't have all this stuff, these limitations, then I'd be free. How can I be free? If only I could calm my mind, if only I could stop the mental chatter, if only I didn't have to live with these difficult family members. If only, then I would be free. And so whether it's rearranging our external world or working hard to rearrange our internal world, we can be doing that a lot on the basis of, I want to be free. And the irony of this is that the more you look at this issue, and that you use particularly the insight meditation to explore this feeling of I am, that these conceits, is that it suddenly becomes apparent that I can never be free. You as a person can never be free, because the person is the prison. The I is like the prison bars. I like to think of it as I. That's what hems the heart in, and so that the yearning for me to be free is it's understandable and it's poignant enough, but it's deeply ironic because the person is the prison, and so that it's that very I feeling that's creating the limitation, although we don't realize that most of the time. Now the way that we often relate to that the feeling of I is we take hold of the Buddha's teaching on not self, and we say, oh well, the Buddha said there is no self, you know, so I don't really exist, so that's fine, right? And we take the teaching on anatta and say, well, the Buddha said there is no self, but that's some of you might be surprised to hear that's a misquotation of the teaching, and you can't actually find anywhere in the Pali Canon where the Buddha says there is no self. And in the one instance when he is confronted with this question, this is when he is approached by a monk called Vachagota. It's so one of these very interesting encounters. So this is Vachagota, who was one of these perennial inquirers, a wanderer who would come and ask the Buddha questions, and eventually he became an arahant, but had a lot of encounters and interesting dialogues before the full enlightenment came. So one day the wanderer Vachagota approached the Blessed One and said to him, "How is it, Master Gotama? Is there a self?" When this was said, the Blessed One was silent. Then Master Gotama, "Is there no self?" A second time, the Blessed One was silent. Then the wanderer Vachagota rose from his seat and departed. Then, not long after the wanderer Vachagota had left, the Venerable Ananda, who's always trying to make everything right, he was always worrying about people being looked after properly. Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Why is it, Venerable Sir, that when the Blessed One was questioned by the wanderer Vachagota, he did not answer?" And the Buddha replies, very significantly, "If, Ananda, when I was asked by the wanderer Vachagota, 'Is there a self?' I had answered, 'There is a self,' this would have been siding with those summoners and Brahmins who are eternalists. And if, when I was asked by him, 'Is there no self?' I had answered, 'There is no self,' this would have been siding with those summoners and Brahmins who are annihilationists. If, Ananda, when I was asked by the wanderer Vachagota, 'Is there a self?' I'd answered, 'There is a self,' would this have been consistent on my part with the arising of the knowledge that all phenomena are not self? No, Venerable Sir. And if, when I was asked by him, 'Is there no self?' I had answered, 'There is no self,' the wanderer Vachagota, already confused, would have fallen even into greater confusion, thinking, 'Hmm, it seems that the self I formerly had does not exist now. Like I had a self when I came here, now... now I'm told I haven't got one.'" So that's the only instance in the canon where the Buddha is asked that straight out, and he remains silent. So there are plenty of teachings on anatta, but what this is pointing to is that anatta is more to do with that analytical method that he's using in relationship to exploring our relationship to the realm of form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. It's a way of exploring that those aspects of mind and body and saying, is this who and what I am? Is this perception? Is this the sound of this voice? Is this mine? Does this have an owner? What is it that does the owning? Who is that? What is that? Does this thought have an owner? Is this really and completely who and what I am? Is this body? in its changing nature. Is this me? Is this mine? Is this what I am? Is this myself? So it's a way of exploring and looking to examine the feeling of selfhood rather than a philosophical position to grasp and say, there is no self. Does that make a... Is that clear? Does that make a... Does that, can you see that's a different approach? These are different qualities? So there's a very wonderful essay which is also quoted in this book. This is, by the way, this is our collection called The Island, the Buddha's teachings on Nibbana. There's an essay by Ajahn Tanissaro here that's called No Self or Not Self. And I won't read the whole thing out, but he explains that this issue in very, very clear and helpful detail. So that when we are looking at this feeling of self, we're not trying to take a position of saying, well, there is no self. There really is no self. And if I could just see that I don't exist, then I would be free. That's not it at all. Because to believe that we have no self, as the Buddha says, is siding with the annihilationists. And as he points out, this is another teaching, he says, these good samanas and brahmins who describe the annihilation, the destruction, and extermination of an existing being at death through fear of personality and disgust with personality keep running and circling around that same personality. Just as a dog bound by a leash tied to a firm post or pillar keeps on running and circling around that same post or pillar, so too these good samanas and brahmins, through fear of personality and disgust with personality, keep running and circling around that same personality. Now all that is conditioned and thus gross, but there is the cessation of formations. Having known there is this, seeing the escape from it all, the Tathagata has gone beyond it. Now, one of the passages that I'm most fond of comes from some verses that the Buddha pronounced shortly after his enlightenment. And this is about his exploration of his own insight that he had awakened to with his enlightenment. And this strange, mysterious, subtle pathway between being and non-being. So, you know, if you reflect on Hamlet's famous soliloquy, to be or not to be, is that the question? Well, the answer is no. Because in terms of the Buddhist approach is to be or not to be, that is not the question. So the answer is no, that is not the question. rather this mysterious middle way that is neither adhering to the quality of being, of eternalism, or of non-being, annihilationism. We're not trying to establish a self that is permanent and separate and secure and happy, or to believe that there is no self and there never was. But rather the mysterious middle way. And he expresses this in this wonderful passage from the Udana. He says, so this was just like a spontaneous utterance shortly after the enlightenment. He said, whatever samanas or brahmins have described liberation from being to come about through love of being, none, I say, are liberated from being. And whatever samanas or brahmins have described escape from being to come about through love of non-being, none, I say, have escaped from being. Through attachment to existence, suffering is. With all clinging exhausted, suffering is no more. Whatever states of being there are, like any kind of conceiving, any kind of I am, of any kind, anywhere, all are impermanent, pain-haunted, and subject to change. One who sees this as it is, thus abandons craving for existence without relishing non-existence. That's really worthy of reflection, isn't it? To abandon craving for existence, so letting go of that urge to be for the I am, but without relishing non-existence, without just switching off, without the relishing of non-being, of the idea of no self. Then he finishes by saying, the remainderless fading, cessation, Nibbana, comes with the utter ending of all craving. Now you might feel he's not really giving us a lot to hang on to there. But this is a really important area of the teaching to explore, particularly if you're interested in insight meditation and looking at how it can be that the focusing on the feeling of I and me and mine, how that continually exacerbates and promotes the feelings of alienation and insecurity and unhappiness, loneliness. And this is really, so it can seem a little bit abstruse or obscure, but it's really helpful to look at how the mind lurches on the one hand to wanting to be something, to be identified with your body, your personality, your achievements, you know, something, or just wants to switch off. Well, you know, most of us wouldn't wake up in the morning and thinking, am I dedicated to being or non-being? You know, that's not really the way we begin our day, is it? But all of us in a similar, you know, in a different way, are similarly drawn to when something affirms us, something that says, you know, good to see you. Well, you're looking great. You're looking great today. Or something affirms us or makes us pleased. Something excites us. Then we love that, don't we? When someone says, "Wow, good to see you," we feel a charge. I think, "Wow, you know, you're looking fine today." Or if we're feeling miserable, someone sort of looks at you and says, "Hello." Oh, are you here? Oh, okay. Then something or something is painful. We get our exam results through the post and you think, oh no, got to do it all over again. Yeah. Or that, you know, the tax returns come back. Oh no. Oh man, I've got to do it all over again. Whatever it might be, you know, whether it's passing exams or paying taxes or, you know, Or you want to go to live in a different monastery and you get a very long understanding letter that says no. Oh. Then what happens is the urge for non-being, like I want to switch off, I want to not feel, I want to just disappear, I've had enough of this, just how can I get numb, right? Whether you're in a lay life or a monastic life, we all have that kind of can have that kind of inclination when things are painful or difficult or challenging, to just want to switch off and not feel. This is what we can call annihilationism, the desire to not be. So looking at this strange middle way between these can be very, very helpful. And there's these wonderful teachings that the Buddha gave on this, and this is a passage from the Itivuttaka. He says, "Bhikkhus held by two kinds of views, some devas and human beings hold back and some overreach. Only those with vision see." And how, bhikkhus, do some hold back? Some devas and humans enjoy being, delight in being, are satisfied with being. When the Dhamma is taught to them for the cessation of being, their minds do not enter into it or acquire confidence in it or settle upon it or become resolved upon it. Thus, bhikkhus, do some hold back. And how do some overreach? Now some are troubled, ashamed and disgusted by this very same quality of being, and they rejoice in the idea of non-being, asserting, "Good sirs, when the body perishes at death, this self is annihilated and destroyed and does not exist anymore. This is true peace. This is excellent. This is reality." The few Buddhist teachers who speak that way as well. Thus, bhikkhus, do some overreach. How, bhikkhus, do those with vision see? Herein one sees what has come to be as having come to be. Having seen it thus, one practices the course for turning away, for dispassion, for the cessation of what has come to be. Thus, bhikkhus, do those with vision see. So, rather than grasping hold of the feeling of I am, or wanting to just switch off and not be, what he points to is this quality of vision, that having seen that which is arising, oh, this is the thrill of being, someone's is smiling at me, someone is praising me, this is a sweet day, everything is good, this is the relishing of being, it feels like this sweet feeling, and then then watching it fade away, this is the ending of that, this is now the autumn, the fading, the dissolution, that which came to be has this cooling, this ending, this dissolution, this bitterness to it. Oh, this is part of the cycle. This is also incorporated in the thrill of being. There's the dissolution, the cooling of non-being, of breaking up. These are all part of the same cycle. Nothing is lost. And so that those with vision are taking the position not of grasping the dissolution or grasping the arising, not grasping spring or grasping winter, but taking the position of knowing, of watching, the place of vision. And that's what insight practice is really particularly aimed at. One of the most helpful practices in this respect is a teaching that Lumpur Sumedho gave years and years ago. I think a few of us were around. I think Ajahn Sundra was there. A few of us old-timers, we were there back in 1981 or even earlier, maybe. Back in the mists of time at Chithurst. We were... I think it was during one of the very first winter retreats that we had there in the sort of ramshackle, old, crumbling, dry rot-filled Victorian house, as it was then. It's this very plush mansion nowadays. But it was a kind of rotting Dickensian, or more kind of Edgar Allan Poe-ish, sort of rot-filled Victorian sort of Gothic pile in those days. So we all gathered together in the shrine room, and Lumpur Sumedho was giving his teachings. And first of all, he was teaching about the meditation on the inner sound, on what's called nada yoga, or listening to the inner sound and learning to use that as a meditation object. And then after a while of teaching that, then he introduced this kind of questioning, using the deliberate bringing in of a doubt or asking an impossible question to help keep the mind alert and open and attentive to the present moment, and a way of cutting through conceptual thought. And the question that he suggested using was the question, who am I? And this was a method that he'd learned from reading the Dharma teachings of Venerable Master Shu Yun, who was an ancient Chinese meditation master. And there was a number of talks from a retreat that he gave in Shanghai when he was 114 years old. He was still leading retreats, so he didn't actually have the word retirement in his dictionary. But there was a man called Charles Luke, a Chinese man from Hong Kong, who was on those retreats, and he recorded the helped to record the teachings and then translate them into English. And these were put into a series of books called Chan and Zen Training. And when Lumpur was in the Peace Corps in Borneo back in the early 60s, and then living in Thailand, he had copies of these Charles Luke books. And during that time, he used the advice from this retreat, the Dharma teachings from this retreat of Master Shu Yun, as his meditation method. And one of the things that he described was this meditation on using questions, or what's called a hua tou, which literally means a head word, is I think how it translates from the Chinese. The hua tou, or kung an, is the Chinese word for the question, which means something like a public record, or koan in Japanese is how it's known. But hua tou literally means a head word, and so that what he describes is, You're deliberately asking a question when the mind is quite focused and still. You bring in a question like, who am I? And it's not just repeating the words like a mantra. That's not the point of it. It needs to be a genuine questioning. And so when you ask when the mind is quite still and focused, when you bring in the word, who am I? Bring that question in. Then it... in a way, it reveals the presumptions that there is a me here, that there is a doer, an experiencer, and that for a moment it interrupts that self-creating habit. And that's the purpose of it. So that Master Shu Yun points out in these teachings that it's not just a matter of repeating the words, but you need to rouse the question. There needs to be a genuine element of doubt raised, because it's that doubt that interrupts the self-creating habit. Because in that moment, when you ask the question, who am I? Then there's a kind of gap that opens up. There's a hesitation in the self-creating habit. And for a moment, the me who's the meditator, the me who's the experiencer, trips over its own feet, as it were. And there's a moment, there's a gap where there's clarity, there's wakefulness, and no sense of self. So during that retreat at Chithurst, back in I think it was 81, might have been 1980. Neither Ajahn Sundra or I can remember. somewhere back there, 30 years ago-ish, he introduced this practice. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, wow, this is great, wonderful, marvelous. But I tended to relate to it then more as just a way of helping to clear the mind of the incessant babble of thinking for a few moments. And it didn't really come to life for me as a practice until some years later, because I'd only been in the monastery a couple of years at that time. I mean, I was really mostly experiencing, as I said, like an incessant babble of thinking, and just the concept that my mind could ever stop thinking more than about four thoughts at once was like a vague dream off in the distance. If I could just cut down to one or two thoughts at a time, it would be an improvement. But as I spent time in the monastery and then did more and more meditation practice, after about 5 or 6 years, I found that my mind really had begun to calm down quite a lot. So some years later, I was living up in Harnham Monastery in Northumberland. And at that time, we had a winter retreat, and there was only about 3 or 4 monks and one or two Anagarikas living in the monastery. It was a very small community, just 4 or 5 people. And it was this time of incredible stillness and quiet. There was about 3 feet of snow outside and hardly any visitors. And it's a very strong routine of meditation practice. And I was probably doing about 15 or 18 hours a day of formal practice during that time. So after about a month of this, my mind started to get really, really quiet. And up until then, the moments where my mind had stopped thinking had been pretty isolated. You see, a few minutes here, a few minutes there. And then on this retreat, with so much time for formal practice and things so quiet and so still in this cold, grey, you know, quiet world outside, things got really, really quiet inside. And I found after about a month that I could think if I wanted to think and not think if I didn't want to think. And I remember it occurred to me, wow, this is great. I can just sit here and not think. After all these years, 6 or 7 years of hard slogging away, and wow, at last, no thought. This is great. This feeling of relief, like, you know, when the fridge switches off, or the traffic finally stops on the outside, and this is great. Then after about 3 days of this, I began to feel, we're very quiet here. Right. No thinking. So, this is it? This is the whole thing? You know, you just stop thinking and this is supposed to be Nibbana? This is kind of boring. And then as the days and weeks went by, it got more and more boring. Till I got to feel like I was just sitting in this grey box. And I thought, this is kind of strange, because I'm doing all the right things. You know, I look around, look at the hindrances. There's no lust, no restlessness, no dullness. My mind is wide awake. I've not got any doubt. All the hindrances are absent. My mind's not thinking. Why is this so miserable? The Buddha couldn't have built a whole world religion around this. I mean, human beings are not so stupid. They cannot be so easily conned that for 2,500 years, this is the best that we could do. There's no way that this can be the goal of spiritual life. So, I'm missing something. I need more light. I need more life. I need joy. Yes. So I thought, well, let's get some metta in here and kind of brighten things up. And so I tried to arouse this feeling of loving kindness. And it was rather like going around with a spray can of pink paint, just sort of covering everything with pink. And that didn't work. It was just like pink grayness, pink-coated, sort of sugar-coated grayness. I thought, well, this is pretty dreadful. Just sort of made like a bitter taste with sweetness on top of it. And I thought, well, this is really, really disappointing. So maybe it's not something that I'm missing. Maybe there's something that's clogging up the works. Maybe there's something that's in the way. What could it be? Because there's no lust, there's no fear, there's no aversion, there's no restlessness, there's no dullness. what's here that's clogging up the works? What is it that's in the way? And suddenly, like the proverbial light bulb, ding! Oh, I am! It's me! There's me, the meditator. There's me, the doer. Me, the one who's practicing. Of course. And then I suddenly remembered this practice of the investigation of who am I that Lumpo Samedo had taught those years before, about 5 years before, and I hadn't really used that much since that time. So I started to use that, and I would just use the question, who am I? And because the mind was quite calm and focused, then it was just like the camera being turned back onto the photographer. It's like, oh, nobody here. But don't look, it's me. And it was so revealing that, oh, it's me. That's this I, me, my feeling, me the doer, me the experiencer, me the owner of this moment. And so just as Master Xu Yun describes, it's not just a matter of repeating the question, but often you have to move it around a bit. So you ask, well, who is it that's having this insight? Who is it that's letting go of self? Who is it that this belongs to? What is it that knows this? And so you're using the questioning to open up that quality of spacious awareness. You're not trying to find an answer. You're deliberately not looking for a verbal answer to the question. But what you're looking for is that huato, the head word, the space, what he says is the unborn or the unconditioned, the space that appears after the question before an answer appears, or even the space before you pose the question. That unborn, unoriginated, open, aware quality. And that as I started to do this practice and really apply that, the experience was like the walls of my grey box just sort of flopped open. And because it had been there for a good month by that time, and it was like the walls of the grey box just sort of flopped open. And suddenly it was like being out in the sunlight, and there was this, well, like the world was full of colour, and there was like fields of flowers all around, even though it was still winter in Northumberland. But the internal feeling was freshness and light and colour and space and liveness. Ah, that was it. So this is an extraordinarily useful practice. And in respect to the theme for the day, it's pointing to, in a way, there's nothing wrong with me as long as we don't take me seriously. As long as we recognize, oh, this is just the ego, the sense of self is just a convenient structure to help us get through a day, so that we can fill in the form of, you know, year of birth, social security number, address. You know, when you need to fill in a form or you get stopped for speeding. You know, when you get pulled over on the motorway, you don't say to the policeman, I don't exist. Or, there is no self, officer. If you wanted a trip to the cells, you'll try that. But you say, oh, no, my name is Amaro Bhikkhu, born September 2nd, 1956. You can use those structures and forms, but without confusion. Just as the Buddha said, when someone said, what do you give all these teachings about not self, but you use personal pronouns. You say he and she and they. You know, what's all this about not self if you're talking about all these supposed people? And the Buddha said, yes, I use the conventions of ordinary speech. I use personal pronouns, but I use them without confusion, simply in order to communicate. So we look at the self and the feelings of self in the same way, that the what's wrong with me is that that is grasped by the habits of ignorance. And that, as Lumpur Samedo is very, very fond of saying, we as long as we can change the paradigm, then everything is fine. Because the paradigm we tend to go with is me and my problems. Here's me and my problems. And if we shift the paradigm to there's the Buddha mind seeing the way things are, there's the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. You've heard him say that before, I'm sure, a few times. Not me and my problems, but the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. And that's not just some sort of vague, remote, metaphysical statement. That's just that's what happens when there's a letting go in the heart, and we let it shift from being me owning these thoughts, owning this moment, owning this body and this personality, to just the arising and passing away of the natural order. That's the Buddha mind, the wise awake mind, seeing the way things are. And I see that the way things are is that Lada is busy getting everything on the counter with her team of elves. The clock is at right angles between the 12 and the 3, so it's time to bring this to a close and offer these thoughts for reflection. So we'll have a bit of a break now, and tea is on offer, and we can come back together for questions and discussion, some Dhamma dialogue in about 20 minutes.